From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Thank you so much for listening. My guest has been really busy, let's say, since the last 25 years. In addition to working with Judd Apatow and James L. Brooks, he shot 17 features for Steven Spielberg. They go from motion capture to a film set in one place, the terminal, from period films to contemporary films. His newest film with Steven Spielberg is The Post. First of all, Janusz, it's always great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thanks for the invitation. This is my second time, and it's always a great pleasure.
Ah, I'll fix that.
Thank you.
You've done so many. In fact, if we do sort of count, basically 11 of the films you've done with Spielberg have been period films. And the thing I find myself noticing, looking for, in fact, and I really look for it here in The Post, is the light source. Because light sources, you want to convey a sense of the period. And so often in period films, I find that the light source tends to be around the center of the room or in a corner somewhere.
Yeah, it's really interesting about the period movies. It's a little bit more, it's very interesting because it sometimes gets a little bit complicated as far as creating the period in the motion picture. I've always looked at the sets and the props and the environment, the costumes, you know, and then I try to think, what would this look like if I was there during that time? To some degree, you really don't have to do much because you're already photographing a period, certain period, whether it's the slave rebellion, whether it's the Second World War, this and that. So you have to use different approach than just the color of lights, you know, and composition. You have to start thinking of what does this feel to the audience, because at the end, it's always about the audience. So we tend to beautify certain periods, particularly when you think of the 60s or when you think of 70s as well, definitely the pre-war time and the 50s. There's a certain patina that goes with that, and that's based on our perception of the period, which is shaped by media. So when you think of the 70s and the 60s, to me, it's always the Lifetime magazine, which is, you know, this beautiful pictorial images of rather warm light with strong backlight, the America of innocence to some degree. So consequently, when I made Catch Me If You Can, that innocence had to be reflected not just in costumes and sets, but also in the quality of life, in the quality of light.
Quality of life, too.
Quality of life, yes. And quality of light. And I had to have that kind of a romantic reflection of that time. Was it really romantic? Absolutely not. It was as dreadful as it could be in the contemporary life. And for some people, it's lovely, but our perception is of that, you know. So, hence my approach, lots of backlights, people look great, the idea of, and talking about the Catch Me If You Can, the idea of a pilot being kind of a aristocracy, royalty.
He's wearing uniforms, and so often
uniforms, they look so great.
There's a lot of royal blue in Catch Me If You Can, isn't there?
Yeah. But also, the light was always, you know, strong on him when he was among people. He needed to look glamorous. Then when you think of, you know, Amistad, which was a slave rebellion on a ship called Amistad, it's a period movie, but the idea is that, you know, everything's illuminated by candlelights,
yes,
and torches, and that goes so fast you can romanticize that because of the warmth of the light, and that's a mistake because it's such a tragic period in the history of not just American history, but the history of the, you know, civilization. So the light needed to be blue, and you go totally against what's expected. So all of a sudden you've got torches, but the light could not be blue from the torch because you're going against the logic. But you pull the color out and you make the white light white. The light coming through the little cells in the windows are pale white towards blue. The African skin, which is the most beautiful skin to photograph, reflects that bluish light and becomes almost as crispy and beautiful like paper, you know. And the exteriors were void of color because you don't want to, in a period movie, particularly in that period movie, that story, to do anything that would suggest glamour or nostalgia or beauty, you know. So my job is to create often the reality of the movie based on what the script is about and how the audience often expects the movie to look like based on their pictorial memories from that period.
It's funny you're talking about that, because I was thinking about how there's no color in the exteriors in Bridge of Spies either. I mean, that's a really kind of a bleak look too, isn't it?
Right. And, you know, it's very familiar to me because I grew up on the other side. I grew up behind the curtain, you know. So the world indeed was grayer. There was no form of advertisement. The buildings were decayed, you know, so everything around was gray. Plus, you heat up the apartments in the winter with coal. So everyone has this kind of a grayish, you know, fog, you know, and looks really, really
bleak. There's sort of coal
bleak.
Dust everywhere, yeah. Because of the coal burning all the time.
Correct, yeah.
There?
Yeah, it's very bleak, and that also diffuses the light. But, you know, there was color in wardrobe, and, I mean, we didn't see our life to be as dreadful as it was from the perspective of time. But, you know, and this movie with The Post, you know, the aim was to, for me, at least on my part, I didn't want to go too deep into a period with light and composition, because it's such a relevant subject matter. It's so, the parallel between what's happening between this administration and Nixon administrations are so clear that I didn't want to create a visual barrier between the audience and the subject matter, where the audience possibly may say, well, this is happening in 1971, has no relevance to what's happening now. So consequently, the light was a little bit cooler. The light was not as pretty. And also the reality of working on Washington Post floor, our set that we've built of the Washington Post consisted of ceiling I've lit it with fluorescent light from the top, because I felt that environment that the journalists worked and basically existed was this environment of high energy, but yet very kind of pale, pasty skin due to lots of coffee and cigarettes, due to not seeing the light and being completely, speaking about the journalists, being completely consumed by what they do, the search of information and not just information, but also the search of believable truth and believable information and truthful information. So it was a fascinating environment and very busy. I suspect it's much different right now, since the, you know, electronic life is so present in the journalistic lives, so they don't have to deal with each other as much as they did before. But it was almost to me, to some degree, felt like the stock exchange floor, where those guys were interacting with each other. And the camera had to reflect that kind of dynamic energy that the journalist room was full of, you know. So we have this, you know, big shots where we're following one character as he's going through the entire floor, enters one room, then enters another room, and finally enters the office of Dan Bradley, who is portrayed by Tom Hanks.
Dan Bradley,
who is portrayed by Tom Hanks. So it was fun to do those particular scenes, because the reality of the scene and the reality of the place kind of dictated the visual representation of that particular location, you know? Yeah.
It's the treatment. We're talking about lights and cinematography and deglamorizing certain worlds with Academy Award-winning cinematographer Janusz Kaminski. It's the second time here. He's here for the new Steven Spielberg film, The Post. And I guess what I was aware of, too, is that constant movement in this one. But, you know, and so often in the films you've done with Spielberg, there's a lot of movement. And I think about how that movement becomes a kind of storytelling. I was thinking about that guy with carrying the box, the Pentagon right. Papers, and just following that. And so often you treat that movement of one character and the way you shoot it as if that is a piece of storytelling by itself, don't you?
Well, it is, especially that it's really, when you read the script, it's very insignificant line in the script, you know, and then Steven turned this into this, you know, very big, important moment, as it should have been. But, you know, I want to briefly talk about Steven's approach and watching this guy, how he morphs into another character. I mean, this is such an elegant, restrained movie in every aspect of it. You know, the performances are very restrained. The camera angles are very restrained. The camera movements are very restrained. It's just such a sign of someone so sure of what movie he was making, so confident that this is the right approach, that, you know, and also confident of the story and the actors. They were just amazing actors. So you really don't have to be really tricky with a lot of things when you have such a story and such a material. You know, you can be as simple as your confidence allows you to be, because it's such a powerful story. So my approach was very similar. You know, I didn't want to be too flashy, although, again, it is me. It's my style. And occasionally, I couldn't restrain myself to be a little bit showy. But I felt I've used it at the right place, particularly when I think of the conversation, early morning conversation, Kay has with her daughter.
You're talking about Kay Graham.
Played by Meryl, yes. They're sitting on the couches, two separate couches. There's a window right between them. The camera is very symmetrical, very graphic. There's a window, and there's a strong sunlight coming through. It's very stylized, you know. It's got a little bit smoke. But to me, it just feels like a morning, you know. Morning of the Hollywood morning. That's how I would reflect morning in Hollywood movies, you know. And I'm fully capable to do different mornings in previous movies.
You've done different mornings.
Wonderful movie called Diving Bell and Butterfly. There was no smoke. There was no beautiful sunlight coming to the window. For this movie, this was my choice because I wanted to show the audience the world of privileged lifestyle. You know, things are just a little bit more pretty. There are flowers on the table, you know. The clothing is a little bit better, you know. And it's not because they pay attention to that. It's just such a part of their life. And Kay was essentially, you know, very much, in my opinion, from what I know, removed from reality of life due to her social economical upbringing, her reality. And the movie, the lighting style reflected her position within the environment. She was always more glamorous. She was always had a more beautiful light, more careful light.
It's funny you say it because between the scenes with Kay Graham, Katharine Graham, and Ben Bradley, it's almost like they're two different movies. I mean, the stuff in the Washington Post we're aware that there's this pressure cooker environment. They've got to move fast because it's the movie is about the publication of the Pentagon Papers, how the Washington Post took over after the New York Times was threatened with court action, and speed is becomes a character in this movie because time is of the essence, and I'm aware of the movement outside of Kay Graham's house. I mean, it seems to be even calmer in the rooms with her than any place else, isn't it?
Correct. You're 100% right. And that comes from, you know, from the story. And also, you know, there's a little bit more of pragmatism in her life due to consequences of her decisions, you know, particularly that she's dealing also with this whole financial responsibility of, you know, making the paper profitable for the Wall Street, you know, and she's just about to put the company on stock market, you know, so it's a big moment for her, but also that kind of she's seen the urgency in life, you know, she's experienced great tragedy in her life, you know, I think personal tragedy, obviously, her husband committed suicide, but prior to that, her father, you know, promoted her husband to run the newspaper simply because that's the time she lived in, not because she was incompetent, but just that's how we viewed women during that time. And the movie is also about that, about gender inequality, and about her struggle to overcome her shyness due to condition that she lived in, due to how the society view women. So you've got these beautiful scenes with her, you know, knowing the answer, but not feeling confident to give the answer. And seeing her breaking through her fears and entering the room full of men where the IPO is being announced, and that's her not rebirth, but finally she steps up to the plate, and to some degree you almost know that she will make the right decision by publishing the
Pentagon Papers. Yeah. And this is also your first time working with Meryl Streep.
What an amazing experience! I've met Meryl previously. We had dinner at one point at someone's house. And of course, I was so taken by her then. I mean, she's just such an idol, not in terms of just being a performer, but also her social views and her stance on her position on what's happening around us. It's so admirable. And she's definitely using her position to promote the right causes, political and social causes, you know.
My guest, who's admirable as well, is Janusz Kaminski. He's the Academy Award-winning cinematographer of many films, including the new Steven Spielberg film, The Post. This is The Treatment. We'll take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I'm excited because my guest is Janusz Kamiński, second time here. His new film with director Steven Spielberg, his 17th. In the last 25 years.
Many movies.
Many movies. His newest is The Post. And one of the things that I guess I notice about you working with Spielberg versus other directors is that there's almost always time is an issue in these films. There's almost always a clock in these films. You always, there's something that has to be done by a certain period. And I wonder if that's one of the things that you respond to, that they're, these characters are kind of on a mission in so many ways in these films, aren't they?
Correct. I mean, obviously, the clicking time is a really nice dramatic device simply because it allows the audience to identify with the importance of the action of the main characters. There's always an aim and the direction they have to go towards, and there's a certain time that, you know, they have to succeed. Otherwise, there's no take two, you know. It works in the past and works in the present and always will work, that idea of, you know, the time is of us of an essence, you know. And we've got the same here metaphorically and practically. This movie came out really, really fast. We've pretty much...
You basically shot it this summer.
We shot it, you know, with very fast pre-production time. I think I had 6 weeks of pre-production. I think the production designer recorder probably had a little bit more. And Roth, who's an amazing costume designer, probably shed maybe 10 weeks. We made a movie, and the movie really pretty much, you know, came out a few weeks after we finished the movie. But, you know, Steven works really hard. He's the hardest working guy I've ever met. You know, he will cut the movie during lunch. He will cut the movie after we finish filming. He will work on the weekend. And on top of it, he will work on supervising the visual effects from Ready Player One, which is such a different movie. We finished that movie just last summer, the principal photography. So he's got this, it's almost like duality of like working with two different guys, you know. I mean, one who is totally focused on this story, how important it is, how significant it is to what is happening right now. And then we go into this big action adventure movie. He goes into it and he's able to advise and supervise totally different world of fantasy, you know. But yeah, the pace was very fast, but I'm used to it. And there was an urgency to do this movie this year simply because the sooner the world, and the world knows it, the sooner the citizens know that history repeats itself and the lies by the government are part of our everyday life, particularly in this particular time where we're learning about the government trying to shut down the legit source of information, which is just what Nixon was trying to do with what he achieved with New York Times in 1971 and with making an attempt to shut down Washington Post in 71. Exact direct words, the same aim, and they failing this time. So the time was of essence to make people aware of, look what's happening right now to this country.
Well, as you're talking about his preparation, I know that so much of these things, on the day he'll come up with something. I remember Matt Damon telling me once, there's that scene in Saving Private Ryan where the young soldier who's kind of the reporter is following basically ammunition being moved mm-hmm. around before the last battle, and that's a single take. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking before about the infectious messenger carrying this box of these papers. So much of this, because your relationship with him, you guys can just decide to do, well, let's just try this thing out. And that's got to be the fun of it, too, that with all that preparation, that there's still room for improvisation. You can just invent something on the shooting day rather than having it all worked out.
Well, it's you know, it sounds, I don't want to sound wrong, but it's the same director. So he, as an artist, he's using often the same motifs in his movie making, and he's the same tools. So continuation of one shot, the example you've used of ammunition belt being passed from one hand to another location and so forth in Saving Private Ryan, and the box, which is basically the ammunition as well. And that thing, the motif of ammunition, is very clear in the movie. The tight shots of the printing press, the tight shots of the letters, all that. The guys are assembling their weapons, you know, and what are
and
the weapons?
And in fact, the printing sounding like guns, like almost
the,
like cannons going
and the
off.
Words are the guns, you know, and we're firing the words at the people, you know. So the interest in detail photography of each little letter being printed, and the precision of the shots that allows the audience to realize how laborious it used to be to print, to manufacture newspaper, where actually you type the thing, you type the word gets transformed into molten
lead, and then the letter
comes out, and then that's how you assemble the paper. Then you get the letters together, and you put them in blocks, and, you know, assemble the paper, and then you print them. So that's really essentially how the paper was done, but there's a clear metaphor of, you know, getting ready for the battle, bringing the bullets in, assembling the bullets, and firing the weapon, you know, which in this case are the words.
It's a treatment. We're talking about ammunition with our old friend Janusz Kaminski. His new film, The Cinematographer, is The Post, the new film by Steven Spielberg. It's now 25 years since you first worked with him. What was your first conversation with him like? Do you remember it?
Oh, boy, you know, I mean, the only thing I remember is that here's this man who does movies, and he's a filmmaker. And, man, I must have something that he wants from me, because why would I be here? So I think, you know, that automatically created really, really good dynamics, because, you know, I saw him as a colleague. You know, if I was asked to do this movie right now, what I know, what he represents, I'll be paralyzed. I would not be able to do a good work, because
really?
I'll be so intimidated by what he represents, you know. So it was a good conversation. You know, he was not aware that I was from Poland. He liked my work based on the little television movie that I shot for Diane Keaton. He liked the photography, but I think deeply there he really liked that within the time confinements of doing television, which is very fast, you know, 18, 20 days, and that's a comfortable schedule right now. Within the 18-day shooting schedule, I was able to create really strong images full of metaphors and meaning. So he was interested in that, you know, someone who is new, who's quick, who's got lots of energy, but mainly he wanted to know whether I'm a kind guy. And I guess it worked out for me and him.
You seem like you're a kind guy to me, but...
Most of the time.
The two times we've talked, you've been very kind. Three times, actually. I guess I was thinking, too, because I know that Diane Keaton uses a lot of photographic references, too.
Yeah, she's great. She's a true artist. You know, she's a very interesting actor, obviously, but yeah, she would bring images as a visual reference. That always works, you know. It's really, really, really comfortable to have point of reference for conversation. I'm not necessarily that crazy about having a image and be told to recreate this.
How often does that happen?
Not often, you know. In fact, often it's very confusing, because when you do movies like Big Friendly Giant, I would get these beautiful illustrations, and they were beautiful, but I felt... You know, they're just too beautiful, you know, and I would go do little tests.
They were too beautiful? What do you mean?
They were too beautiful. They didn't look real.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was to create some kind of, not to create fully fairy tale, but have some kind of believable...
A visual reality.
Visual reality, you know, within the story, right?
That's because that gets back to where we started the conversation, which is, for me, always... I'm so aware, and I make a point of seeing these movies a second time, which I generally don't do because I don't have the time to do this, but because I want to see, look for the source, the light source. And for me, the source of light, as much as the quality of light, tells me when these movies are taking place. And I think that's got to be a big part of it for you too, doesn't it?
You're 100% correct. You know, if you analyze, you don't even have to analyze paintings, but there's always window in the frame, a candle, a torch, you know, simply because... The source of light is very important in pictorial representation of reality, or just in pictorial expression of the artist, you know. When you go into different style in painting, the light source becomes abstract because the art is so abstract. But in anything that is reality grounded, based in reality, there's always light source. So for me, since I'm trying to recreate reality or my impression of reality in totally... artificial environment, by placing the light source, I'm telling the audience that there are some references, not just visual, but practical references of reality within the frame, whether it's the window, whether it's candlelight, whether it's a torch or a lamp. We always want to use that as a source of light for two different reasons. You know, one, it's a source of light. Another, it's a nice element of composition, framing the shot. Usually you would want to put a little bit of a lamp in the frame because it just creates contrast, visual contrast. You get a bright object in the frame, which is the lamp, and then you manipulate the level of the light on the human face in order to reflect what that person is going through. So, cliche, you put a light in the frame, the actor is further away from the light, a little bit mysterious. As the camera stays in the same position, the actor comes closer to the light, reveals him or herself, and delivers the line. Or maybe they just come closer to listen to make sure that the audience understands the importance of that particular scene, you know?
I guess you talk about drama, too. I'm thinking about you worked with two directors and did comedies with James L. Brooks and with Judd Apatow. And what were those conversations like when you meet those guys? Because they're very different visual schemes in both of these films, How Will You Know, and Funny People, than there were in the movies you've done with Spielberg so far. What were those conversations like?
I just have to say that it's very easy to discredit comedies as a genre that has low expectations on visuals. In fact, the track record of recent movies proves contrary to expectations. You know, there are some great comedies done lately that have very interesting, strong visuals, you know, and when I did Jerry Maguire, that was the aim. I wanted to create strong visuals through lighting. Same with James L. Brooks, you know. With Judd, things were slightly different because we did so much improvisation. So when you improvisation, you do have more than two cameras. The shots become a little bit wider. You have to give the actors space to not just improvise through verbally, but also through physical expression. So you take that for account, and you don't necessarily compromise the lighting, but you accommodate the scene and the work style to facilitate the needs of the scene. Then many times in other scenes, simple dinner sequences with Judd Apatow, they were a little bit more dramatic. The lighting was a little bit more dramatic.
And the Thanksgiving dinner, for
Correct,
example.
Yes. With Mr. Brooks, you know, things are so different because he's such an iconic figure. You know, I mean, I've met James when I was married to an actress that was in his movies, and it was just fascinating to meet him. And she loved James. She loved working with him, you know. And he was always this friend that knew a little bit more about my wife than I did because he worked with her. So I was drawn to him, and he wanted me to make movies with him for a very long time, but I just couldn't do it to being busy. And finally we made How Do You Know. It was a really nice experience. You know, at the end, James makes movies through close-ups. So we would have big wide shots, but really he's interested in medium shots and close-ups simply because, rightfully, he feels that this is where you get the emotions of the character, you know. He's a very funny guy as well. You know, I remember Location Scouts, you know, it was just very, very interesting experience. Different from another experience, you know. And his laugh, you know, during the performance is so characteristic. Occasionally, I can still, when I watch the movie, I can hear him, you know, the laughter on the track, you know.
Well, we're out of time. Things always go so fast. Janusz, thanks so much for being
Great.
Here again.
Maybe we talk about Ready Player One in the future.
You know what?
Fantastic.
Okay, you know what? You can come back anytime you
Such
want.
Such a different experience.
I can't wait until you come back to talk about that. And you will. My guest who will be back here for Ready Player One is Janusz Kaminski. He's here now for the new film, The Post. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DiLaguila. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm one of those people with the beautiful African skin that Janusz is talking about. It's the treatment.
And the light is gorgeous on you right now.
Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.